Latin America's solidarity with Palestine.
Latin America is a hub of support for the Palestinian cause. From Venezuela to Brazil to Chile, the call for the liberation of Palestine is a powerful force to be reckoned with. There have been many examples of Latin American leaders taking strong stands to support the Palestinian resistance. On the political level, Chile, Paraguay, Brazil, Argentina, Bolivia, Uruguay, Ecuador, and Venezuela have all recognized Palestinian sovereignty over the West Bank and Gaza. Chile is home to almost 500,000 Palestinians, who constitute around 2.5% of the country's population. The feeling of solidarity with Palestine in Chile is palpable, and while significant Israeli interests do exist in Chilean society, there have been some interesting developments. In 2022, the newly elected president of Chile, Gabriel Boric, cancelled the credentials ceremony for the new Israeli ambassador and promptly dismissed him from the presidential palace when he heard of the Israeli military killing of Odia Salah in Jenin. It has since been announced that a Chilean embassy will be established in Palestine. Aside from the political side of the equation, there are also material connections between the resistance and Latin America. But there have even been several fighters from Latin America who joined the ranks of Palestinian resistance groups and directly participated in operations like Carlos the Jackal, who attempted to assassinate the vice president of the British Zionist Federation at his home in London. The late great president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, refused to condemn Carlos the Jackal, even under pressure from the French embassy, stating that he was a good friend and a steadfast fighter for the Palestinian people. The US government and other nefarious actors have long accused Hugo Chavez of harboring active cells for the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah in Venezuela. It was alleged that Chavez provided safe haven to the only group which has successfully driven Israel out of Lebanon, the resistance group Hezbollah, in the Venezuelan territory of Margarita Island. The current Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, who himself has been the target of several US assassination attempts, has publicly spoken of his close relationship with the late resistance leader, General Qasem Soleimani. Maduro claims that when Venezuela was subject to US cyber attacks, it was Soleimani who came and secured Venezuela's systems from North American skullduggery. When asked about his country's commitment to the liberation of Palestine, Maduro responded, "No one in this world dares ask us to abandon Palestine. It is a sin just thinking about abandoning Palestine. Palestine is the sacred land of mankind. Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people will be paid for by the occupation one day." Despite Israel's best attempts to subvert the will of billions across the world, Palestine is not alone, and Latin America stands firmly with it.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller, who's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University. David's a director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's recently been appointed as a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zaim University. Our guest expert today is Pablo Navarrete. Pablo is a journalist and a documentary filmmaker. His work includes Inside the Revolution, a journey into the heart of Venezuela, and No Extradition, which traces the struggle of Julian Assange's father for his son's freedom. And we spoke to Pablo earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, which of the governments in Latin America, in your opinion, would you say have been, you know, the most supportive, stood out in their support for Palestine?
Well, as we heard in the film there, there's quite a lot of the Latin American countries have recognised the Palestinian state. And indeed, many of the countries who come from a tradition of struggle against authoritarianism, they're the ones who are most likely to be supporting the Palestinians. Obviously, Venezuela is a standout case, and the Venezuelans have been absolutely at the front of absolute support for the Palestinian cause, and indeed for the support of other armed movements around about West Asia, including in Lebanon with Hezbollah. The Chilean government recently, of course, the new Chilean leader sent back the new Israeli ambassador as a result of the killings of the IDF in the territories. And, of course, even let's go further back. I mean, countries like Nicaragua and Cuba and indeed Bolivia more recently have been very supportive of the Palestinian cause.
Certainly set the standard, I think, for the rest of the world, in my opinion. But anyway, we asked Pablo about Chile's bond with Palestine and how deep it actually runs.
Okay, so I'm the son of Chilean political refugees. I'm born and raised in the UK. Now, Chile is the country that has the biggest Palestinian population outside the Arab world, and there are between 300,000 to 500,000 Palestinians, is estimated, and take into account that Chile has just under 20 million people, so it's not an insignificant population. Now, the roots of this population date back to the late 1800s, Christian enclaves around Bethlehem, Palestinians that left for Latin America, but principally the population in Chile came after the First World War, again, Christian predominantly, that settled in Chile. And initially it was a kind of more secular, progressively orientated in terms of politics population, but as it has embedded itself, many have done very well with business, and this population has become, in terms of at least of the representation, which is estimated to be about 6,000 Palestinians that form a kind of body, a Palestinian body that represent the community, which is, again, not much, 6,000 out of potentially 500,000. But this representative body is more conservative, has close ties to Chile's elite. So I think also interesting to think about is expressions of concrete solidarity with Chile. And here, I think it's worth mentioning the Palestinian Football Club of Chile's first division that was created in the 1920s and has, you know, if you go today to the stadium, you will see Palestinian flags, one of the only places where you'll see the Palestinian flag waved freely and, you know, chants of Gaza resists, Palestine exists.
David, Latifa referred to the legendary Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez in her report. I mean, just tell us what his stance was on Israel.
Well, Chavez was an uncompromising advocate of the Palestinian cause. I think one of the things you've got to remember here is that the scepticism that there is on the left in Europe and parts of the world towards Islamic revolution is not held so strongly in Latin America. They come from a Christian background, predominantly Catholic, yes, but they're much more able to understand that religion can play a role in revolution than is the left in Western Europe, I think. And that's partly because of the role of the Christianity in the liberation struggles in Latin America. So we see a much easier connection between Palestinian liberation and the liberation movements of Latin America. And that's something which, you know, Chavez, socialist that he was, understood very well.
Indeed. Well, I also asked Pablo to outline the attitude of the new Chilean government about Palestine.
In December 2021, a former student leader turned lawmaker, Gabriel Boric, won the Chilean presidential election, and he won it against a far-right politician who was the son of a Nazi army officer. Cast was the surname, and someone that openly said he still admired the fascist US-backed dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet that ruled between 1973 and 1990. So Gabriel Boric is someone that, as a lawmaker, has effectively supported levels of BDS, has come out denouncing Israel in the past. And his government, since March 2022, I was in Chile when he became president, has made a number of symbolic gestures, which I think are important, but perhaps shouldn't be overstated. There was there were credentials for the new Israeli ambassador that were essentially postponed in September after the latest killings by the Israeli government of Palestinians. But that, again, much was made of that. But 2 weeks later, Boric, the government, apologized and did accept the credentials.
David, what do we know about the links between Venezuela and Hezbollah, which, of course, as we know, has been proscribed in this country?
So the Venezuelans have been very supportive of Hezbollah, as they have of the Palestinians, both Maduro and Chavez have said, you know, we will not be abandoning our allies, and these are people who they regard as comrades in arms, and not as terrorists or as Islamic fundamentalists, as many people on the left in Western Europe would say.
I mean, Latifa also referred to a character known as Carlos the Jackal. What do we know about him? I remember there's quite a bit of publicity about him about 30 years ago.
So Carlos was one of these sort of fictional terrorists for the Western media, someone who's so bad that even the mention of his name was enough to get to the front page of the tabloid press. Now, of course, he was a Palestinian guerrilla, and you know, unlike many people in Western Europe, the people in Latin America who support Palestinian liberation weren't willing to just throw people under the bus because they were engaged in armed struggle. So that's the key thing. There's an unflinching ability to say, no, we stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Mm. It's curious, isn't it? Because as I mentioned, there was lots of publicity, I remember, at the time. I mean, why do you think it is that the Western media sort of focus on a character like Carlos the Jackal?
Well, they have to create the idea that there are these individuals who are motivated by some kind of personal animus or by some kind of religious drive, and that these are people who are in some way mad. That's what the whole idea of terrorism really is that these people are committing terror against civilians, they will say, they're not engaged in struggle against military forces. And the problem with these people is not just that they have a belief and they're fighting in relation to what they regard as justice, but they are somehow mad, right? Mm. And that's the idea, that's why you have Carlos the Jackal. You have this name to indicate he's kind of like a serial killer. That's what the way they want to make it. These are people are mad and bad, and not people who are motivated by a political motivation, which of course was the reality.
No, indeed. And of course, another legendary Latin American figure, Fidel Castro, of course, someone else who I think has stood out in solidarity, you know, with revolutionary struggles in Palestine.
That's right, in Palestine and indeed in other places. I remember she, of course, travelled to Africa to support revolution there.
Che Guevara, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm just going to pause the conversation there now for a moment because we've got another quite shocking report, actually, about the relationship between the previous far-right president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, and the Israeli regime.
Many have questioned who the most pro-Israel Latin American leader has been. The winner of that dubious competition may well be former Brazilian president and military officer Jair Bolsonaro. It is believed that his emotional promotion of the Zionist project stems from his aim to ingratiate himself with his Christian evangelical electoral base. But Bolsonaro has gone over and above his servility to Israel. At Palestine Declassified, we question if Bolsonaro has facilitated the penetration of Brazil's armed forces by Israeli intelligence. Benjamin Netanyahu was the first Israeli political leader to visit Brazil following the election of Bolsonaro. He proudly hosted Netanyahu at a synagogue in Rio de Janeiro, where they announced a brotherhood between their countries with the intent of increasing economic, military, and technological integration. Bolsonaro bestowed upon Netanyahu the highest national honor for visiting political figures, and the Brazilian post office released a special stamp to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the Zionist entity, featuring a picture of Netanyahu next to the word Savior in Hebrew. Bolsonaro was in turn crowned with a Friends of Zion Award in occupied Al-Quds. The family bonds between the Bolsonaros and Israel are so strong that the former Brazilian president's sons have been pictured wearing IDF t-shirts, and his wife even delivered her vote in the most recent election wearing a t-shirt emblazoned with the Israeli flag. The most sinister part of this story is Bolsonaro's role in submitting the data of the Brazilian army to an Israeli cybersecurity company with an umbilical relationship to Israeli intelligence. In March 2022, the Israeli company CySource signed an agreement to train the Brazilian military in cyber defense. The CEO and founder of the company is Amir Barel, who is reported to have worked for Israel's external intelligence service, Mossad, before entering the private sector. He also previously worked with the Israeli spy company NSO Group, which developed the Pegasus software that has hacked the phones of journalists, human rights defenders, and politicians around the world. CySource is also part of the Israeli cyber companies consortium, led by the arms company Israel Aerospace Industries. The consortium was founded in 2016 by Israel's Ministry of the Economy to, quote-unquote, provide an overarching solution by Israeli cyber companies to the needs of different national-level cyber agencies. In addition to granting this deal to CISORCE, a Brazilian lieutenant from the military, Luiz Katsap, was appointed as the global sales director of the Israeli company. How can the Brazilian military protect its sovereignty from Israeli espionage?
David, would you say that Bolsonaro takes the award as the most pro-Israel Latin American leader probably in history?
Possibly in history. I mean, he is clearly very strongly pro-Israel. And you saw that his son's there with the IDF T-shirts and the Mossad T-shirts you can buy in Israeli airports as you travel into the country. I'm not sure if they sell them to just everyone, but they are certainly available. And but let's think back in history. I mean, the Israelis have a strong record of intervening in Latin America. And back in the days when the military ran Argentina, there was a strong role there. The Israelis supplied weapons to the military dictatorship there, including in a period when the dictatorship was rounding up Jews. And the Israelis didn't balk at that. They still supplied the weapons. So there's been a long history of involvement. And, of course, what they're doing in Brazil now is trying to penetrate the Brazilian military to get the data. I mean, anyone who thinks that these cybersecurity companies are just there for business reasons hasn't thought for more than 2 minutes about it. I mean, this is a conscious effort by Israeli intelligence to branch out into the corporate world and to use the corporate results for Israeli intelligence's own benefit. So, you know, certainly Bolsonaro is a very strong pro-Israel character, but he's not the only one by any means.
Well, I asked Pablo what he could tell us about the farcical Venezuelan opposition figure, Juan Guaido, and his relationship with Israel.
Yeah, Juan Guaido was a far-right, again, politician, a sort of a bit of a nobody, really, in Venezuela, known by only 20% of the population when it was decided by the U.S. and others that he would be the latest attempt to effect regime change in Venezuela, something they've been trying since 1999 when Hugo Chavez first came to power. And obviously, under Chavez, you know, support for Palestine and Palestinians' resistance against the savagery of Israel and what it does daily in Palestine went up many notches. And obviously Israel viewed Venezuela under Chavez as a threat. And so Guaido was this, you know, self-pathetic sort of figure, really, that decided that he'd call himself the president with the support of the UK and the US and other sort of imperial states. And even though now even the opposition have discarded him, he's still someone that the UK, I think, recognises as the president. It's all sort of farcical and pathetic. But he, you know, when he declared himself president in February 2019, he said he would restore diplomatic relations with Israel immediately. Obviously, something that had been, you know, not been the case for 10 years prior under Chavez broke diplomatic relations. He said he would open an embassy, and so he was really kind of, you know, very much a puppet for U.S. imperialism, for what Israel is attempting also to do in the region. But really, he's just a sort of a washed-out figure now that has no relevance, but, you know, continues to be, you know, thought of as some kind of president by people in London and in Washington.
David, what else can you tell us about CISORCE that was mentioned in the last package about Bolsonaro?
So CISORCE is a cyber defense company. We've seen on the show a number of different cyber defense companies and tech companies which have been, you know, rolled out of Israeli intelligence. And the plan clearly is, with all of these companies, is that you create these commercial vehicles, you staff them with ex-intelligence officers who then will have some kind of relationship with Mossad or even with Shin Bet internally in the Zionist entity. So if you look at it from the point of view of Mossad sitting in Tel Aviv, and they have all these different cyber defense companies and cybersecurity companies and tech firms, CISORCE is one of them, as many others we've looked at in this program, what you see is the ability to try and penetrate the information infrastructure of different countries. In the UK, for example, we saw only the other week, we did a show on Oracle, the Zionist firm in America, penetrating the Ministry of Defense in this country. And this is what Cisource is up to in Brazil. It's about penetrating the data, which allows them to penetrate into the fabric of the running of the Brazilian society. And that's what they're doing in all the countries in which they're engaged.
Mm. And of course, Bolsonaro is a former military officer, isn't he? And I just wonder, do you think it's possible that he's opened his country up to Israeli espionage then?
Well, this is obviously what the Israelis are trying to do. They try and do it in the UK and the US, which are their notional allies. And of course, they'll do the same in Brazil. If Brazil thinks it's just an ally and they're going to work together, well, no. I mean, they're going to be penetrated, and the Israelis will use that to their own advantage, either to project their own power in Latin America or to gain power against and subvert the Brazilian state itself. So, you know, we're now in a position where Lula is the new president of Brazil, you know, what's going to happen with those contracts? I mean, if Lula knew what he was doing, he would, of course, have cancelled these contracts and removed the Israelis straight away, but that hasn't happened yet.
No, indeed. Of course, the thing is, though, I mean, has Bolsonaro facilitated it, though? I mean,
Of course he has. I mean, once you get these contracts in place and you appoint Brazilian military people to the boards of the companies, you're fusing together Israeli foreign policy interests and the security interests of the security state in Brazil.
And finally, David, I mean, looking ahead, how do you think the Palestinian and Latin American relations will develop in the years ahead?
Well, I mean, you have to think about this in terms of how you think the revolution in Palestine is going to develop. And from my point of view, it looks like we're entering into a new intense phase of resistance in Palestine, with the possibility of the full liberation of Palestine within the next few years. Mm. And that will mean that there will be an increasing need for solidarity, but also an increasing desire to give solidarity, because what happens usually in these sort of scenarios, whether it's an anti-colonial revolution or an anti-settler colonial revolution, is that once the liberation movement comes closer to liberation, that the support rallies all around the world. And you saw that with South Africa, you saw that in relation to a number of other countries, Algeria. So what we'll see is, with Latin American countries, is especially those which are already supporting Palestine, that their support will intensify and it will be added to by other countries which will come on board.
Mm. Do you think it's significant that that solidarity is more pronounced in former, you know, in countries that were former, you know, subject to, you know, colonization by Western powers?
I don't think it's just that they were subject to colonization, but it's that they have their own immediate history of having to win their freedom through armed struggle. And that's the key clincher, isn't it? People understand that you've got to fight, you know, if you're going to overthrow military dictatorships. And people in Western Europe don't really have that history. Mm-hmm. Not in the last 50 years.
Yeah,
whereas people in other parts of the world do have that history.
No, indeed. Well, I'm afraid the clock's beaten us again today, so we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank our guests, Pablo Navarrete, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you. Don't just leave it there. The stories and scrutiny that we provide are being suppressed by corporate media and big tech. So help us to beat the censorship by sharing today's programme on social media. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
With only 64 X-ray and 73 kidney dialysis machines, 7 CT scanners and 1 MRI, combined with West cruel sanctions against the quake-hit Syrians, doctors in northwest Syria are racing against the clock to treat 8,500 injuries. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Nature wrote in this regard, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake that struck Turkey and Syria on February 6th has killed more than 50,000 people and flattened multiple cities. More than 4,500 of those who died and 8,500 injured are in northwest Syria. Its already depleted healthcare system, 4.7 million people share just one MRI machine, is on its knees. More than 10,000 buildings are completely or partially destroyed, leaving 11,000 people homeless, according to the United Nations Humanitarian Agency, OCHA. The earthquake also destroyed warehouses that store medicines. Hospitals in this region have been overwhelmed as they attempt to accommodate thousands of injured people in spaces with severely limited beds, medical supplies, surgical equipment, and intensive care facilities. More than 8,500 injured people need to be accommodated in only 66 functional hospitals, providing 1,245 beds for short hospital stays, according to the WHO. Moreover, all of northwest Syria has just 86 orthopedic surgeons, 64 X-ray machines, 7 computerized tomography, CT scanners, and 1 magnetic resonance imaging MRI machine across the region. According to WHO, compiled data published towards the end of 2022. The region's critical lack of healthcare is partly caused by hospitals and medical staff being targeted during the war, explains Ek-Zayes, who is a co-investigator on a UK-funded project called Research for Health System Strengthening in Syria. In a separate study, Ek-Zayes estimated that as of June 2021, 350 medical facilities had been attacked and 930 healthcare personnel killed. AKS says people are running all over the place to make use of any existing resources, including basic ambulances. The medical staff have been working nonstop, adds Habusa, who is working at the maternity hospital in Idlib when the first earthquake hit at 1:17 universal time. The hospital occupies the 5th and 6th floors of a building. Habusa said, "We had to evacuate the incubators and move all the babies to the ground floor." According to 3 doctors who Nature spoke to in northwest Syria, the most common injuries are limb fractures, trauma injuries, crush injuries including crush syndrome, damages that result in organ dysfunction including kidney failure and bleeding. People with crush syndrome need intensive care and dialysis, says cardiologist Jawad Abu Hatab, who is Dean of Medicine at Aleppo University in northwest Syria. However, the region has only 73 renal dialysis machines, according to the WHO compiled data. Abu Hatab adds there were also cases of cardiac arrest from the shock and horror of catastrophe. The medical community is also preparing to deal with more cases of post-earthquake trauma, especially among children and women. Doctors say They urgently need more dialysis machines and orthopedic surgery equipment, along with painkillers and antibiotics. These supplies were not abundant before the earthquake and will now run out, says Habusha. Truthout wrote in this regard, the devastating earthquake in Turkey and Syria has killed many people. The destruction is unfathomable. According to the UN, at least 870,000 people across Turkey and Syria are in urgent need of hot meals. In Syria, around 5.3 million people are in need of shelter. And over 1 million people in Turkey are living in temporary shelters. It feels like another punch in the gut after the horrors and anguish Syrians have already endured through years of war, displacement, and sanctions. Heartbreaking stories have emerged from Turkey and Syria. In one widely shared image, photographer Adam Alton memorialized the anguish of a father as he sat alone amidst the rubble holding onto his deceased 15-year-old daughter's hand. Stories of rescue have also ignited flickers of hope amid such profound despair. The earthquake is the latest crisis within a larger crisis in Syria, already fractured over a decade now. Over 300,000 people have been killed there since the war broke out in 2011. Prior to the earthquake, an estimated 6.7 million people were already internally displaced. Millions more were impoverished by U.S. and European sanctions designed to strangle the economy. Additional U.S. sanctions since 2020 have targeted key sectors, including the central bank, oil, energy, and construction. They have also blocked food, medicine, medical equipment, and other necessities. 90% of Syrians now live in poverty, and 12 million are food insecure. With more than half of Syria's infrastructure either destroyed or severely damaged by war, sanctions have made reconstruction and economic recovery impossible. This was the situation before the earthquake struck. Months earlier, UN envoy Alina Duhan called for an end to sanctions, saying, "I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction," she said. Her recommendation has even greater urgency today. In a de facto admission that sanctions are hurting civilians, the U.S. Department of Treasury recently agreed to open a 180-day window authorizing transactions related to earthquake relief efforts in Syria. Although a welcome development, it's only a short-term reprieve from these sanctions' far-reaching catastrophic impacts. For the U.S., maintaining these failed sanctions while pledging to be a partner to the people of Syria is contradictory and counterproductive. They should be permanently lifted to allow Syrians the chance to finally catch their breath and begin to rebuild from these crises with dignity. The U.S. and international community must also redouble their diplomatic efforts toward ending the war instead of prolonging it. Tragedy should transcend political divisions, not reinforce them. According to RT, the effects of the devastating 7.8 magnitude earthquake, which hit both Turkey and Russia earlier this month, are being compounded by Western sanctions. But despite a temporary relaxation of restrictions on the war-torn and shaken country, problems still exist. Syrian provinces have still been left ill-prepared to deal with the scale of disaster that has befallen them and must now be given every support to reconstruct their country. According to the authorities in Turkey and Syria, as many as 50,000 people have been killed by the devastating earthquake, with at least 23 million people affected in total. Millions have been temporarily displaced, and many more still await news on their loved ones and whether or not they survive. The situation, as it stands, is another utter disaster, and the full impact is impossible to convey in mere words. In Turkey's case, the international community's response was unanimous. Aid was pledged, teams arrived to relieve the suffering, and whatever the political frictions between Istanbul and some Western nations, a sense of universal humanitarian camaraderie prevailed. The Biden administration in Washington reacted to the natural disaster by pledging anything that Ankara needed, while the European Union mobilized emergency response and offered its Copernicus satellite mapping service to help first responders in Turkey. However, the situation has been very different for Syria, with only a few select nations quick to come to its aid. The U.S. regime stated that it would not cooperate with Damascus to deal with the carnage inside Syrian territory. The Syrian government officially requested help from EU, which some EU states instantly refused to provide. The UK quickly came to aid of their NATO ally, Turkey, but refused help to the suffering Syrians. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted his condolences to Turkey and its people in Turkish, but failed to acknowledge Syria at all. Syrians were not in the spotlight to receive help from the West and are actively being ignored, in spite of the gravity of the situation facing them.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws about purity according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei.
He was born in 1939. When he began his Hausa studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest as speaker. We are still talking about the rules of purification according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, let me start with you with this question, Sheikh Javid. Is it permissible to do or to make the wuzu, you know, with the intention of offering the daily obligatory prayer before the beginning of its time?
Well, it depends largely on when you would like to make wudu, you know. If it's too early to make wudu, that is the time when, for example, wudu is not basically wajib, then of course you cannot you know, make niyyah of the obligatory wudu, because at that time you are not required to make wudu.
Right.
And you cannot make niyyah for a wajib wudu when it's too early, okay. And of course, if a little while before the time for prayer you want to make wudu, then it's okay to perform wudu, because rationally speaking, if you want to perform your prayers in the very early portion of the time prescribed for prayer, then you have to you have to actually make wudu for a few minutes before the time, you know. So to put it in a nutshell, there is no problem in doing wudu with the intention of performing the daily obligatory prayers a little while before it is prescribed time, not too long before the prescribed time. That's what His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says.
A quick question, Sheikh Javed, I may squeeze in here, is that if you make the intention of wudu actually for a recommended prayer,
yes,
can you do? Say the prayer which is obligatory with the same wudu?
Sure. Of course, you can make you can perform prayers with the obligatory prayers with the wudu that you have made for a recommended or a mustahab prayer or a nafile prayer.
Mm-hmm.
It's always in order to perform a wajib prayer with the wuzu made for a recommended prayer.
Uh-huh, I see. Okay. Thank you very much. And the other way around is also it's possible, also, right?
Yeah, of course.
So you
There's
make
no
the intention of
it.
The obligatory prayer and you say the prayer which is recommended
yes.
with the same.
Because what's necessary is ritual purity, which is gained by making wudu. And of course, as long as you do not do anything which violates or which breaks the wudu, you can go on praying and doing any kind of ibadah that requires ritual purity.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back with more questions regarding the rules of purification here in this program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And our guest speaker is still Sheikh Jawid. We are talking about the rules of purification. Sheikh Jawid, somebody asked us this question. Let me just read the text. My feet are affected with paralysis and I walk with the help of medical shoes and clutches. It is not possible for me to take off the shoes for wudu. Please explain my Sharia or jurisprudential duty concerning the wiping of the feet. Would you?
Well, basically, it is obligatory to perform, wiping or masah on the feet without any barrier, without shoes or socks, you know. In the event that removing the shoes proves to be very difficult or unbearable, of course, wiping over the shoes is sufficient
mm-hmm.
and valid according to His Eminence. According to the fatwa of Grand Ayatollah Khomeini. Of course, in this regard, there is some discrepancy among some scholars because, as far as I know, some scholars do not consider such an act to be valid. For example, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khomeini says that one has to perform tayammum in such this scenario.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay. Another question regarding tayammum, because we talked about this, you know, after searching for water in range of several farsakh, right?
Yes.
We found only some dirty water. Is it obligatory to do tayammum in this condition, in this situation, or to make the wudu with the same dirty water?
You know, sometimes the water can be muddy and there is a solution. You need to wait for a while so that the mud subsides, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the water gets pure. If that's not possible and the water remains to be dirty, then of course you cannot make wudu with dirty water, which is no longer called pure water
mm-hmm.
or unmixed water, because we always have to make wudu with unmixed water. The water which is not mixed with any other things, with water from juice, from fruit, of course, with other ingredients. Okay, of course, we know that there are the water itself has its own ingredients, but in common view, the water should be considered pure and unmixed water. As long as the water is unmixed, of course, you can make wudu with it.
What about seawater?
Seawater is unmixed. Of course, it's purifying. It's always purifying, and there is no doubt about it.
But it's though very it is, much salty.
Though it is saline, it is salty.
Salinated.
It doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't affect your wudu. And no, when it comes to your question, the main point that you said, for example, you said that you asked whether it's obligated to do tayammum in such a condition when the water is dirty, and of course pure water is not cannot be found. Of course, His Eminence says that if the water is pure and unadulterated, and there's no harm or fear of harm and using it, of course, it's obligatory. There's no doubt about it to make wudu.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's not the occasion for tayammum. In such a scenario, tayammum is not applicable.
Mm-hmm. I see. Another question, Shachavid, regarding the intention of the wudu, you know. Is wudu in and of itself recommended, mustahab? And is it valid to make wudu for the sake of nearness, proximity to God, before the time of the prayer arrives? And then after that, after the time of the prayer, or azan, then you can offer the prayer with the very wudu?
Yeah. Doing wudu, for the sake of being in a state of purity is always mustahab, because it's recommended for a believer to be in a state of ritual purity, and it is preferable according to Islamic Sharia, and it is permissible at the same time to perform prayers with mustahab wudu, of course, so basically performing wudu to be in a state of ritual purity is always recommended. Mm-hmm. Whether you engage in any kind of prayer or any kind of dua or supplications, or you do not, but being in a state of ritual purity is always preferred. And if you look at the life, at the normative conduct of the religious scholars, we see that they have always been in the habit of making wudu to be in a state of ritual purity. Great scholars whose life story we read,
mm-hmm.
And some of them we are acquainted with, of course, they have been in the habit of making wudu to be in the state of ritual purity, and that shows and clearly suggests that being in a state of tahara is recommended,
mm-hmm.
and of course it's permissible to perform wudu. To perform prayers with recommended wudu.
Wudu, I see.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Chavit, for your nice answers to these questions regarding the rules of purification based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for listening to this program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيٍ مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.